little bit short-handed today, so we're going to try and get our work done. Oh, Senator Farioli, welcome, as quickly as possible. We have several bill introductions, a Senate confirmation hearing, and hearings on three measures. We're going to do the measure introduction request, and I'm opening a work session on measure introductions. Mr. Stembridge, can you tell us what we have?
Madam Co-Chair, you have a request from the Physical Therapists Association. Stephen DeFore is drafting LC 1673. I have this memo. I did not make copies for the members. I can pass the memo around if you'd like to see it.
I've already seen it, so it's passed it to Tony.
You've seen it?
Yeah.
Okay.
You get here early, you have time to look and do your homework.
Thank you, Jay.
Watch it, Roger. Okay.
Do you want more detail on this? Just before he's here,
no.
If you'd like to hear from him.
Okay. You're okay? You're okay?
Okay.
Okay. All right. We need a motion to approve drafting request for LC 1673.
Madam Chair, I move that we have a drafting and introduction of LC 1673.
Is there any discussion? Senator Carno has moved that we allow the draft request to go forward on LC 1673. Any discussion? Any opposition? So approved.
Madam Chair, you have two legislative drafts from Senator Winters. Do you want to take them one at a time or both?
Let's do them both at the same time.
One is LC 2202. It is related to enterprise zones. LC 2007 is relating to ombudsmen.
Ombudspeople, we hope.
It says ombudsmen. So it's a one word, ombudsmen.
We want ombudspersons.
Right now.
Okay. Anyway,
it's okay. We'll deal with it.
That's
okay.
Like Engelperson Spruce.
So,
would you move
have the numbers? Are they here?
They are. Actually, they're right here.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move we accept the LC 2202 and LC 2007 as drafts to be introduced by the Rules Committee.
Senator Carno has moved that we introduce LC 2007. I'm sorry.
I think that Senator Winters would like to introduce these herself. Is that how it works, or does it have to go? Does it have to be through the Rules Committee?
Okay, I'll amend my motion. The LC drafts, as submitted by Senator Winters, be drafted under her name and through the Rules Committee. Thank you.
Senator Carno has moved that we introduce both LC 2007 and LC 2202 by Representative Winters. Is there Senator Winters? Sorry. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the motion carries and the requests are approved. Next, we're going to do a work public hearing and a work session on executive appointments under consideration. And we would ask Jack Isselman to come forward. We are proposing him for the chair of the Economic and Community Development Commission. Hello and welcome.
I'm
getting ahead of my staff.
I just wanted to point out that I have, on several of the documents that I've distributed, I'm saying presiding officer of the commission. There is in the statute, it does say the governor will name a presiding officer, but the Senate confirmation is for members of the commission. So Mr. Isselman has been appointed as a member of the commission only.
Okay.
They probably didn't tell him that before he took the
job. I didn't know that before I made the drive.
I'm just saying that's kind of between him and the governor.
Okay. Please proceed.
Good. I have some prepared testimony, senators, if you'll oblige. My name is Jack Isselman. I live and work in Washington County, Oregon. I am married and the father of two daughters. One is age 2, and one is 1 month old yesterday, as a matter of fact. My employer is Electro Scientific Industries, Incorporated. ESI manufactures and sells high-value capital equipment to the global electronics market. In short, what that means is we don't make cell phones, but you can't make one without our equipment. The same is true for a range of electronics products. ESI employs approximately 700 people. Of these, 520 work in our headquarters in Portland, and 79 work in our 50,000 square foot manufacturing facility in Klamath County. Our Klamath County facility, incidentally, was completed in 2001 with assistance from the state and Klamath County. Since 2000, I have served ESI as its general counsel. ESI's shares trade publicly on the NASDAQ national market, and we are among the top 20 largest public companies in Oregon. Prior to joining ESI, I worked as an attorney for Intel Corporation in Hillsboro, Oregon, and prior to that, the Portland-based Stoll Reeves Law Firm. I've also worked at Tektronix Corporation in Wilsonville. I hold a Bachelor's of Arts degree from the University of Southern California, and I received a law degree from the University of Maryland. My interest in joining the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission stems primarily from my experiences at ESI through the past several years. As I know each of you are aware, and as has been borne out in Oregon's revenue dilemma, the electronics industry is experiencing one of the most significant downturns in our history. The downturn is compounded by the fact that it comes on the heels of record expansion. When I joined ESI 3 years ago, we employed 1,600 people, the preponderance of whom were Oregonians. Today, our full-time headcount sits at 690, and workforce reductions continue. Many of my former coworkers who left over 1 year ago remain unemployed, despite their substantial qualifications for employment and a fervent desire to work. Simply put, Oregon needs jobs. It is my goal to work with Marty Brantley, my fellow commissioners, the Oregon business community, and the entire Economic and Community Development Department to foster job creation in Oregon. While the department, like all of state government, must adjust to operating within more limited means, its fundamental mission must be to invest in sustainable, quality jobs for Oregonians at the least cost. Although the state's investment dollars are reduced, investment in Oregon's economy must continue. We cannot cut our way into prosperity. Given the state's limited and dwindling resources, Oregon has no alternative but to be more selective in the economic investments it pursues. The connection between Oregon's economic investments and job creation must be apparent to all Oregonians. Government on its own may not be able to create any single private sector job, but it can create a fertile environment for job creation. Some of this can occur without spending. For example, achieving the governor's goal to streamline state permitting such that 90% of the permits are cleared by the state within 90 days of receipt would bring welcome relief to a small business community beleaguered by red tape and undue regulation. And I can think of no more obvious way to plainly state to businesses that there's room for them and their workforce in Oregon than by increasing the availability of so-called shovel-ready industrial sites, as has been proposed by this administration. The road ahead is not clearly drawn for us. Uncertainty and frustration pervade much of our public debate. However, it is in recognizing that we can rise above it. The choices we face are difficult and often unpleasant. I know we will not always agree on the proper course. However, I also know that as Oregonians, we each care deeply about the future of our state. And with this as our focus, I'm confident that we can work together cooperatively to lead Oregonians to the brighter days that I know are ahead. Thank you. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Any questions? Senator Corcoran.
Madam Chair, I just want to reiterate a discussion I had with Mr. Isselman the other day. I took him down to Senator Gordley's office and introduced him because Senator Gordley had made a very good comment a few days before about the fact that we have to be really conscious in economic development choices that we don't try the next newest trick in town, and you know that we pay attention to what's worked for us in economic development and not keep directing the Economic Development Department in new directions when they've just started going down the road they're going down now. So that was my only comment to him. And I thought that was Senator Cordley's notion, and she's in our caucus, probably paid more close attention to economic development issues than anybody else. And I just wanted to have Mr. Isselman respond to that, despite the fact that he's a terrapin. He's a terrapin.
That's right. I cannot deny that. I'm also a Trojan, and which is an odd combination.
Trojan terrapin.
Would you like to respond?
Well, certainly I agree. And having spent some time at the department, it's important that we recognize what we've already asked the department to do and not make wholesale changes that will frustrate a lot of productive activity that's already occurring at the department. That being said, I come from a business that makes its money on precision and being very precise. We process memory links that are less than a fraction of a width of a human hair. And some of that precision and focus, I think, needs to be instilled at the department, and Marty Brantley is working towards that, so that our investment dollars are really properly targeted towards attainable and reachable goals. And I think at this point, those goals have to be squarely focused on job creation.
Senator Farner.
Yes, Jack, I would just say that I think in looking at the budget 2 years ago, Representative Betsy Johnson and myself went thoroughly through the economic development budget and worked very hard to determine what was wrong. Obviously, there's been a lot of things wrong for a long time, but if there's statutes and mandates, which we looked at pages and pages of those that have been passed in this legislative process to try to get the department to work better, if there's things in that that you see that we need to change, please notify us, because we do want you to be very successful. Along with Marty Brantley, we're very pleased to have this combination. So,
good. Well, we've been reading the statute, and I think you can expect we'll be back.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Any further questions or comments? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senators.
Since we are already in work session, I am looking for a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the appointment of Jack Isselman to the Oregon Economic Development and Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission.
Thank you. Senator Clardo has moved that we accept the appointment of Jack Isselman to the Economic and Community Development Commission. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Do not look a Trojan terrapin in the mouth.
Okay. No discussion. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion is passed. I would like Senator Atkinson to carry it if he's able to do so. If not, I suspect Senator Beyer can fill in.
So. Be honored.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for coming to Salem.
That'll be
with that, Senator Farioli. Okay. We'll be at ease for a minute until Senator Farioli gets here. I really didn't see him there. Jack? Oh, I thought he was in. This is his first.
We could bring Ted Rettlinger up here and have him talk to us about San Francisco Giants.
Okay.
No.
This is
the
one for.
Have they made any good off-season trades? Really? More interesting.
Okay. Okay. He's very always at the committee. Did she know that Pam knew that?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. If we could have, we're going to open a public hearing on SJR 5. I might have John Lynn back come up until we see the whites of Senator Farioli's eyes. If you don't mind if we interrupt you when Senator Farioli arrives. I figured you wouldn't.
Looks like stutter over there, Senator Farioli.
Farioli's eyes. Thursday afternoon.
Yes.
Haven't had any chocolate today. What can I say? And before you proceed, I'm going to have Jim do it, Mr. Stembridge do an overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure.
SDR 5 is a proposal to amend the Constitution. And the amendment would go before the public at the general election in November of 2004. And it would amend the Constitution to limit the reasons for recalling a public office holder to A, malfeasance in office, B, misuse of public funds, C, violation of the oath of office, or D, violation of law.
Oh, Senator Ferriello, your timing is perfect.
Come on up.
Yeah, you going to help us with this recall bill?
Recall bill? I thought this was a RICO bill.
Well, you would be the... Never mind.
Never mind. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the reason I've sponsored this joint resolution is to try to get people to think about how our recall laws are being used in the state of Oregon. I don't know if my district is any different than anybody else's district. Go ahead.
Ferriello, are you looking for a response to that?
No, not really.
Okay.
But it seems like we have an abundance. Yes.
I hate to interrupt, but I have no idea who this is in front of us.
I beg your pardon. Madam Chairman, State Senator Ted Ferriello.
And when he asked me who was in front of us, I said, huh?
For the record, Madam Chairman. And I'll begin again. And I'm not trying to punish the committee. I don't think my district is much different than anybody else's district. People in my district really do cherish their rights of petition, redress, recall, and initiative. I mean, they really, really believe that they're almost sacred rights, and certainly they're constitutional rights. But there's been an unfortunate trend over the last decade, and that is just an abundance of recall petitions at every single level, municipal, county. And I've watched these recall petitions, and I really haven't gotten engaged or involved in any of them except as an observer. Often they are connected to issues that are, I think, personal issues rather than community political issues. I'll give you an example. In one community, a delinquent water bill came to the attention of city council members through the offices of the city manager. And he was directed, at the behest of one city councilor, to collect the overdue water bill. It seems to be a relatively routine matter, maybe one that doesn't even rise to the level of the presentation to the council. You know, it should have just been in the ordinary course of business. The attempt to collect the water bill precipitated a political squabble in the community, resulting in a recall petition. In the particular community, there were less than 300 residents of the city, less than 300 registered voters who reside in the city. So the need to collect 15% of the numbers of people who voted in the last election amounted to 8 signatures. So with 8 signatures, a recall election is forced, you know, and that causes some expense to the city and to the county elections officials. And then there's the required response by the object of the petition for recall. And then there's the inevitable arguments for and against in the voters' pamphlet, and a possible defense of the recall effort. We're talking about, you know, all triggered from a water bill and 8 signatures. And as a result, the entire city council resigned, you know, just in protest over the idea that the effort to conduct normal and customary business in this small community could result in the recall of one of the members. And so the entire city council resigns, and then now the county government has to step in and become the de facto operators of the incorporation. They become the officers of the corporation in default. So this thing has a cascading effect, and I think over the past 4 or 5 years there's been about 20 recall efforts in the district, in District 30. There have been several at the county level, several at the municipal level and several in special districts. And as I've gone through the petitions and looked for the reasons for the recalls, the reasons can be, well, the person in the office does not represent me, or the person was disrespectful to citizens of the community, or the person that is the subject of the recall hasn't adequately discharged the duties of the office. And the, in point of fact, the reasons for recalls can be so insubstantial and vague that it almost defies characterization. Nevertheless, I'm getting some help from the Hatfield School of Public Policy. They're going to go through the all the recalls that have been filed in the state of Oregon for the last three biennia and list the reasons for the recall and whether they were successful or not successful and the cost of the elections. And I'll bring that information back to the committee. But the bottom line is this resolution would ask Oregonians to consider at least a specification for recall that rises to the level of malfeasance in office, a misuse of public funds, a violation of the oath of office, or a violation of law. And it could even be city ordinance, or it could even be a minor violation. It wouldn't even have to rise to the high crimes and misdemeanors kind of the statute. Washington State has this sort of a model in their recall law, and their recall law is much less frequently used to punish recalcitrant public officials at whatever level, from library boards to school boards to city councils to county commissioners. And I think the risk that I acknowledge that I am running here is that some of my constituents have written that they feel that this SJR 5 would infringe their constitutional rights and take their constitutional rights away from them. I see this not so much in terms of an abridgment on constitutional rights, but protection for people that are primarily volunteers. They don't get paid. They serve in the community because they care about the communities. They stand for election. In most cases, there aren't any dollars spent on the election. You know, we're talking about special district elections and city council elections. And they are uncompensated. They take the risk, they put their personal reputations on the line, and then they become targets for people who have access to grind against government, all government, government with a B. And I think that asking folks to serve and take the risk is one thing, but unreasonably exposing them to recall petitions and public ridicule is a whole different animal. So here's the deal. I think we ought to specify the purposes for which recall petitions should be filed, and I think we ought to make people who want to file recall petitions specify what the problem is. And it can't be so vague as they don't represent me, or I don't like the way they treat people, or I think it ought to be something connected with their ability to conduct themselves in the office. The other thing is we already have, and I think all of us have said this ourselves, a perfect term limit mechanism, and that's the term of office. And if you don't like the person, you vote them out in the next election cycle. But I think we've wasted a lot of money on special elections and a lot of money on recall, and most of the time it's just meant to punish an individual for an unpopular political stance. That sort of brings to the end my testimony, and I'd love to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Ferriola. Does anybody have any questions?
I don't have any questions, but as you sit here and discuss this, I thought of two in my own district that have occurred in the last couple of years, so I'm sure they'll be on the count that the Hatfield group is doing.
There, that Lincoln County, Madam Chair, was prompted, the school board was recalled because they closed the school in Ithaca. And it was an unpopular decision, of course, but, you know, this is the Lincoln County School District, and they are in a hell of a mess.
Madam Chair, you might make an addendum to this SJR and say that the people that do the recall have to serve.
Well, Madam Chairman, in some cases, the people that sponsor the recall have just been through an unsuccessful attempt to become elected.
Yes,
that's true.
And, you know, they sit around grinding their molars for 6 months because the statute says you can't recall anybody unless you give them 6 months to do something wrong.
Senator Ferriola, was there a specific statutory reference defining malfeasance that you had used?
Madam Chairman,
or that you intended to use?
That's an excellent question, and let me explain that if I can use your question to launch into a little bit of explanation about all the things that are wrong with this bill, at least that I've found so far. The folks from the Secretary of State's office do not want to be the arbiter of whether or not the there's any validity to the charges of malfeasance or misuse of public funds or violation of the oath of office or violation of the law. So they're concerned that if we put these things in there, that the elections officer is going to have to determine the validity of the charge before they can take the petition. We don't want to put them in that role. That's not the intent. There are some legal definitions for malfeasance and misuse of public funds. There is no legal definition of the violation of the public office, oath of office. That's a little bit fuzzy. So the nice thing about this is that I've checked with the legislative council, and if you'll notice, and this is something for the scrapbook, you can take this one away. There's no relating clause in this SJR or any other SJR. So apparently they're infinitely revisable, and I hadn't realized that, but just to point that out, I learned something there. There needs to be a tightened definition and a probably better definition of who are the actors and what are their responsibilities under a RICO. My objective was to try to get people who want to pursue a legitimate recall to be able to specify what the basis for the recall is with specificity. And I don't want to put the elections officials at the county or the state level in the role of having to be the arbiters of that case. That's not their job. There are some statutes that exist in other states. We're looking at through the councils of state governments to find what might be serviceable in this event. We're working with legislative council to figure out a definition that will be a little less nebulous, and we're working with the Secretary of State's office to figure out what might work.
Okay.
So I imagine what we'll do is be coming back with your indulgence to try to make a bill that works. Something that we can refer to voters, and I guarantee you that this will be one of the hotly contested issues on the ballot. And there is a cost to this, by the way. Making the referral causes the state to spend some $37,000 for to participate in the special election process in the general election.
I'm sure we can manage a way to take it out of your salary.
Ma'am, if you'll take my check, we can do business right now. The check will bounce, ma'am. But
well, thank you for bringing this very interesting issue to us, and we look forward, unless there are more questions, to more testimony after Senator Walker testifies on another bill, and look forward to you bringing back answers to those very intriguing questions.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I appreciate the committee's attention and indulgence. I think this is one worth exploring a little bit.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And with
you
that,
say snowball's chance in hell.
Well, Madam Chairman, we're still pumping our own gas, and we're still not paying sales tax. And people do regard this as a sacred right, so I think it's worth raising the issue. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we'll temporarily close the public hearing on SJR 5. Sorry, Mr. Lindbach. And open a public hearing on both Senate Bill 318 and Senate Bill 319. Senator Walker, if you would come forward, and Mr. Stembridge, if you would give us a brief explanation
yes,
of both bills.
Madam Chair, SB 319 and 318 both have to do with write-in candidates. One sets a deadline for the write-in candidates. If these are successful write-in candidates, having to file a statement of economic interest with the Government Standards and Practices Commission. The other bill sets up a deadline and timetable for accepting the nomination for the office to which the write-in candidate was elected.
Great. I can't remember if I pounded the gavel, so. Open the public hearing. Thank you, Senator Walker, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for waiting. I was in another committee testifying and raced up the stairs. I'm Vicki Walker. I'm State Senator for District 7, and I'll speak to Senate Bill 318 first. You have a dash one amendment to that bill that simply deletes the word date and inserts the word deadline. I have a crack second-year law student. She's so good. And I asked her to compare Senate Bill 318 with its companion bill from last session, and she found this one word that was different. So council changed it to provide consistency. Senate Bill 318 I introduced last session, and it was House Bill 2173. It passed unanimously in the House and just came over here and quietly sat in committee until we adjourned and went away. It simply requires all candidates who are elected at the primary election in a write-in vote to file the same statement of economic interest that you all have to file when you file as a candidate. And it sets a deadline for them to do so. I've passed around to you a set of documents that includes an editorial from the Register Guard back in 2001 describing why these bills are important for the public. Also, some information in an email from Legislative Council, and then my initial letter to Legislative Council in July of 2000, and his response explaining why indeed these bills are necessary because the statutes are not clear. So, in terms of Senate Bill 318, that's really all that I have on that bill. Does anybody have any questions?
The amendment to Senate Bill 319, maybe you mentioned it.
I haven't discussed 319 yet.
Oh,
so
sorry. Okay.
I just wanted to see if you're okay with 318, and then we'll move to 319.
Let me see if there's any questions on Senate Bill 318.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. On the amendment, Senator Walker, is this amendment needed because you were changing date to deadline in other places in the statute? Is that... Or did you say that it's different from the bill you introduced last year by that, or last session by that word?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, the statute uses the word deadline elsewhere instead of date. And so we wanted consistency. Legislative Council said it really made no difference, but I like consistency and said, if it's not a problem, could you change it? So we've changed it back. And lest you think I thought my intern had better things to do, I just wanted to make sure that we had the same bill because it did look a little different because statutes had changed from last session that also changed the language from the bill I introduced last session.
Anything else, Senator Corcoran? Any questions?
No, I think my question is for 319.
Okay. Please proceed on 319.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 319 requires a candidate nominated by write-in vote to accept or reject their nomination within 45 days. We allow 30 days after the general or the primary election for the votes to be counted. The results of that would be sent out to the candidate, and they then have 15 days to accept or reject that nomination. Again, the reason for the bill is because there's no timeline set in statute. This bill was House Bill 2171 in the 2001 session and did again pass unanimously in the House. There was a -1 amendment for this bill that just completely went away because it fixed some problem in subparagraph 10 because of some change that happened last session. But in discussing with Secretary of State's office and counties, they wanted the whole subparagraph 10 to go away because they wanted the dates to remain the same, 45 days for lots of other things. And I can have John Lindback explain that to you. So we've just deleted that entire subparagraph 10 and several other sections that weren't pertinent in the -2 amendment that you have. And I know in discussing this issue with some of you, Senator Beyer had a question. He was concerned about the necessity of this bill. Why do we need it? Why do write-in candidates need a deadline? And if I might explain, I think it's important that write-in candidates need a deadline so that voters and other candidates know the lay of the land. As it is now, there's no requirement in statute for that candidate to accept or reject at any point in time, though they would have to accept or reject within 60 days of the election because the ballots would be ready to go out and their name could not go on the ballot until they accepted or rejected. Additionally, if a write-in candidate was elected at the primary and decided it's a major party write-in candidate, decided I'm not going to run, it gives that party an opportunity to field another candidate because that's what elections are all about, is giving voters an opportunity to make decisions. And if this writing candidate waits for 3 months to make a decision and then suddenly says, hey, I don't want to accept the nomination, it makes it very difficult for another candidate to be fielded in that election. So that is why I believe it is necessary. Again, the statute is silent. You can read Legislative Council's opinion that says that it is indeed silent. We don't really have a date. That's why I'm here.
Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Walker, I don't think you answered my question yet that I asked you on the floor yesterday. What happens, or what would happen in this case, in the case when a candidate for one of the major parties wins the write-in for the other party's nominee in an uncontested primary? Would that person's then name then appear in both places on the ballot come November?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Beyer. I did forget that one question, and I think John Lindbeck hopefully will be able to answer that. If I could call him forward.
Sure. While John is coming up, my experience with that, having gone through that a number of times in my election, is that you are not placed in both parties' names, that your primary party is essentially the party that you run under. So, but Mr. Lindbeck can give us the nitty-gritty details.
For the record, I'm John Lindbeck, Director of the Elections Division, and you're exactly correct, Senator Brown.
Madam Chair, that did prompt a second question. If could the person who won the write-in still accept the nomination of the other party that they had just won, or would that, in effect, say they cannot and open the door for the other party to field a candidate to then run against them?
I'll take a swing at that.
Please do.
Senator Beyer. They can accept the nomination of the other party, but their name will not appear associated with the other party on the ballot. Your name appears at the party with which you are registered, and you are the nominee.
And, John, you couldn't then run. I'll just use my own example. I've been nominated a number of times. I know it might scare you as the Republican nominee in my Senate district. Assuming I accept the nomination, which I do, the Republicans in the district then cannot run someone against me, essentially, for that Republican slot.
That's correct, Senator Brown, and that's the incentive for someone to accept the nomination of the other party.
But if you were not to accept the nomination, then they in fact could.
Correct. Uh-huh. But since the Republicans are demanding that I be their nominee, I choose to accept. Thank you. Anything else on Senate Bill 318 or 319?
Madam Chair, I just had one additional thing I forgot to mention on Senate Bill 319. The county clerks were wanting this bill as well, because in local races they have a number of write-in candidates and there are no deadlines at the local level either, and it creates a lot of confusion. So this just sets some dates for everyone to live by.
Great. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearings on Senate Bill 318 and 319. Thank you very much, Senator Walker, for joining us. And we'll open a public hearing on SJR 5. Mr. Lindbeck, please proceed.
Okay, back to SJR 5. I had a very good conversation with Senator Ferrioli on this proposal earlier in the week, and expressed my willingness to work with him on it. As it's currently drafted, we have a couple of concerns. And I have been an elections official in a prior jurisdiction that had a law like this, in which there were specific reasons under which candidates could be recalled. And that placed the responsibility with the filing officer and their legal advisors when recall petitions were filed to determine whether or not the reasons cited fell appropriately into the categories cited under the law. And it places that responsibility with the filing officer to determine whether then a recall petition can go forward. What it also does is it places one more responsibility with the filing officers for which they can get sued. And we got sued with great regularity over whether or not we were going to let recalls go forward. And so this whole issue of who decides whether or not somebody, whether or not the reasons cited on this petition recall form would fall into one of these categories and are sufficient is a big issue with regards to this resolution. The other questions we would have would be a definition of misuse of public funds. Because as you see, the four reasons cited there, one of them is misuse of public funds, but another one is a violation of the law. And the fact that that one is broken out suggests that there could be some sort of misuse of funds that are that are short of a violation of the law that would be subject to recall, and it would be very helpful if somebody's going to be making these decisions to have some guidance on what misuse of public funds means. And that concludes our concerns on that, and we are trying to work with Senator Farioli on these issues. It is absolutely true that there have been communities in Oregon wrapped around the axle as a result of recalls. I mean, Sheridan and Lafayette come to mind. The clerk from Yamhill County could tell you some real horror stories. So.
Any questions for John? Thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
Dave Barenberg, come on up.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Dave Barenberg, Legislative Director for the League of Oregon Cities, and we would like to testify in support of SJR 5 and like to work with, or are working with, Senator Farioli, and like to work with the Secretary of State's office and the committee to perfect some of the problems with the bill. I think Senator Farioli hit a lot of the major issues right on the head, that it's just been a major issue in a wide range of communities across the state where there have been recall efforts for reasons such as they're doing a lousy job and they want to take away your rights, has been some of the reasons that have been cited in various cities. And Senator Farioli said that most cities in Oregon are relatively small. You take whatever the voting the percentage of folks that voted in the last gubernatorial election and take 15% of that number, which is the number of signatures you need to get it on the ballot, that in many, the cost is approximately a dollar a voter is what's turned out to be the cost in some of these elections. But the one interesting thing I found in just surveying some of the cities where recalls had taken place or recall elections had taken place was even if they were defeated soundly, oftentimes the elected officials would decide not to seek another term. It just was something where they're volunteering their time, saying, who needs this aggravation? We run for office and then, you know, just end up spending our time fighting a recall effort rather than being able to move forward on doing some of the things that we really would like to do in our community. In cases, because of recall, staff is left, and it's just created a very unsettling environment there. So we would support the efforts to move forward on this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on SJR 5? With that, we will close the public hearing on SJR 5 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 318. Does anybody wish to testify? Not seeing anybody, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 319. Could I have John Lindbeck come on up, and Al Davidson, why don't you come on up at the same time?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Al Davidson. I'm the county clerk from Marion County, here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. And we're here in support of Senate Bill 319. As you heard Senator Walker say, our interests are much more at the local level, because we have many, many special district positions that get filled by write-in, as well as many, many city council positions that get filled by write-in. And we're the kind of people who like, we already have about 10 chapters in the statutes that lay out deadlines of when things are supposed to happen, and that worked well for us to know when things are supposed to happen. And what has happened in a couple of instances is that the city where a candidate was elected by write-in did not know up until the time of the swearing-in ceremony whether that person was going to accept or not accept the election. And it seems to me like that there ought to be some time before that, so that the city or the special district boards can plan for their indoctrination and training and those kinds of things that go into preparing a person to accept public office. Those are our interests, and I thank you very much for letting me appear, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Go ahead, Senator Parno.
Maybe I missed something earlier, but are the people that run for office, are they not notified they need to accept the nomination, or why?
Madam Chair, Senator Clarno, people who win write-in nominations are notified, but there is no requirement that they respond to that notice at any given time, and that's what we're seeking to accomplish here.
Okay. Understand.
John?
I'd like to echo the comments of Al Davidson. The current statute does not give us a deadline as the filing officer for state candidates. When we write these people a letter currently, we give them a generic deadline that we just sort of respond by such and such a date. We have no statutory basis. If they don't respond by a certain time, we'll try to beg them to respond again. If we still don't hear, then we report it to the parties, and a lot of time is spent wasted trying to reach people who don't respond, when the political parties could be getting right with the if a deadline like this was set, then the political parties would know sooner if they had a problem or not with respect to having a name on the ballot. So it would help us administratively. It would help the parties. This is a good bill.
Any questions for either of these two people? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is anybody else in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 319? Seeing nobody jumping up and down to testify, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 319. Is there any other business that needs to come before the committee? With that, and seeing the excitement on my committee members' faces?
The only thing I was going to say, Madam Chair, is that I think Senator Metzger has a bill that clarifies vote-by-mail election, we need clarification on what happens if the candidate dies. And I think he's talked to your office about that. I wonder if those bills should all come. Like 318, I don't know why 318 and 319... and that one need to be separate. They're all relating to the voting process.
We maybe didn't. I don't remember seeing that bill in front of our committee. We don't have it yet.
We don't have it yet.
We don't have it yet. I'm sure we will get it, though.
Might make sense, just for the sake of brevity, to pull all the election stuff together.
I'm for making things short and simple. And on that happy note, we are adjourned.